Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is David Levithan, publisher and editorial director of Scholastic Press. And today we'll be talking about Scholastic's most recent release, which is incidentally the most anticipated book of this year, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, and just released and available, as you know, from our curbside pickup at Wellington Square Bookshop here in Eagleview in Exton, Pennsylvania. You can see it in our window. You can order it as a drop ship, or you can get it at curbside. So the book that everyone is talking about is the prequel to Suzanne Collins' Hunger Games trilogy, which, of course, unless you've been in a cave or hiding behind a rock, you certainly know about, and you've certainly seen the movies. And so while David, in addition to his duties at Scholastic, has renowned history as an author, we have to kind of put him on the shelf, so to speak, and concentrate on Coriolanus Snow's as a child and the protagonist of this novel, set in Panem, 64 years before the Hunger Games we know so well, with a 16-year-old Snow as a mentor, hopefully, at the 10th annual Games. His mentee, a lowly resident of District 12, which he's really unhappy about, is Lucy Gray. Snow is a different person as we commence the book, unshaped, a boy entering manhood, his qualities morally, intellectually, and physically still being molded by his history, the history of a city, of a civilization, and a family. There are many reviews out there already, and there are tons of spoilers, so I hope that I'll keep within bounds as we discuss this latest and earliest visit to the Hunger Games. So welcome, David, and thanks so much for joining us today.
No, thanks for having me.
You know, it may be different, but what I wanted to talk about first are the excellent epigraphs at the beginning of this novel. Are you familiar? I'm sure you're familiar with them, but aren't they interesting?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and I laugh because literally the first conversation that Suzanne and I had about this book, she joked, but with seriousness, saying it was time that I had to brush up on my Locke and Rousseau. And I did. And it became very handy for reading this book. And so when the manuscript came in with all the epigrams, I was like, yep, this is the entire philosophical basis for the book right here up front. So yes, it's very telling.
And it's funny because I always think stuff like this is really good for young adults. Not only are her books really good because just like the Harry Potter series, which is also Scholastic, they lead kids and young adults onto other books that they might not otherwise realize. And that's, to me, that's like, you know, these two people are heroines. So anyway, Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Rousseau, Wordsworth, and Mary Shelley, all of which, again, should be read by young adults. But the concept of all those epigraphs follows through in the book, and it's basically about you can be good, you can be evil, there is power, you can abuse it or use it. And it's all about not only the issues in this book, but the issues in the entire Hunger Games series, correct?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it is, the series is an examination of power and an examination of war and just the individual choices that go into making the systems that we all are subject to. And certainly, I think with Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, Suzanne really took it in a different direction than the trilogy, in that it is told from the point of view of somebody who is perched sort of on the eve of power. Katniss, obviously, in the first, in the trilogy, is about as disempowered as you can get, forced into a fight to the death, whereas Coriolanus is coming from a totally different direction, and really, his life is not at stake, it's more his position that's at stake, and yet it makes him do things that are just as desperate as those that Katniss does in the arena.
So without me getting into things that might be spoilers, right, let you give us a synopsis of what you've been telling people about what this book is all about.
I have not been able to tell anybody anything for the past year.
Oh, that's true. It's so one day.
Like putting on my training wheels. I mean, it was literally Lucy Greybeard's name was not revealed until the book came out yesterday. So when you mentioned it in your introduction, I thought, wow, yeah, no, I guess we can say Lucy Gray now. But no, my pitch would be that it is about young Coriolanus Snow, who comes from a very elite family, but an elite family that is hiding the fact that it has fallen onto very hard, desperate times. And he is desperate to keep his family standing and keep his position and also keep people from knowing how poor the family really is. And his device for success, as he sees it, is to be a mentor for the 10th Hunger Games, which again is 64 years before the first Hunger Games novel had. And basically he thinks he's going to get a plum assignment, but instead he is assigned to Lucy Greybeard, who is the District 12 female, and he thinks she has no hope. But she sort of understands instinctively what he does not, which is that the Hunger Games is a show, and that if you don't necessarily have the most brute strength or the most stamina, there are other ways to get support and to play the game instead of just brutal killing. And so she has her agenda, he has his agenda, and the book is really about how their agendas combine or don't combine as they are sort of forced into being partners to try to help her win the 10th Hunger Games.
Okay, well, another question, so I can be sure I'm not pushing the envelope too hard or too far. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what the capital is like in this short transition period since the victory over the district rebels?
Oh, certainly. That I think, I mean, I keep jokingly calling it Weimar Panem, because it is, I mean, and it's not a spoiler to say that it is there between wars. We know that even from the trilogy, in that, I mean, the first war is the one that sort of decimated Panem, and the rise of the districts and the rise of eventually President Snow comes from that. And then, of course, the trilogy is the other end of that, where the rebellion takes place. So basically, they are still very much recovering. It is like the Reconstruction period or the era in Europe, sort of a few years after World War II, where there's a lot of rebuilding, there's a lot of poverty, there is a lot of authority being asserted in order to try to keep rule after the decimation of war. And within that time, again, there are the haves and the have-nots, as there always are. And the capital is trying to at least portray itself as being the bastion of the haves. But as we see with the Snow family, some of the haves actually don't have nearly as much as they used to.
Yeah, that was surprising at the beginning. I did not expect that. I had assumed that, okay, it's been 10 years, the capital had rebuilt itself, but it was a shock to realize that in some ways it was as badly off as many of the districts were.
Yeah.
And that was kind of actually there's a lot of the book in the beginning that is unexpected. And I guess the most important aspect of it is Snow himself. And Snow ends up on top, that concept. But as I said in the introduction, he's a different person. And I don't think that's giving away anything because it's in all the reviews. So he's a different person than he becomes. Kind of like, well, never mind. I won't give examples, but you know what I mean.
Right. No, I mean, he's a teenager. I mean, I think that is the most important fact in my mind about the Coriolanus Snow that is in the book, is that he is very much a teenager, and that certainly he has certain inclinations and proclivities, and certainly has a demeanor that comes from his breeding. But at the same time, he is just a teenager. There are no doors have been closed yet. There's nothing about his personality that has been fully formed and written in stone. And so that, I think, is the fascination of the book, at least to me, is to see sort of how he ends up taking the path that he does. We obviously know where he goes in the very end, but at the same time, I think it is ridiculous to think that anybody's life is a foregone conclusion, whether they be hero or villain. And I think what we see with Coriolanus is sort of all of these smaller things as well as the bigger things that lead him to take the direction that he does.
Yeah, it's funny in life how there are those moments, kind of like the road less traveled, when you can choose one thing or another and it's a pivotal point in your life. And he has several of those. And that not only draws the reader in, but somehow also agitates the reader, because I think the reader can remember some of those moments in his or her own life. Did you find that to be true as well? I bet you did.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, again, especially looking back and paralleling to one's own teenage years, I mean, the hot-headedness, the stubbornness, the utter inability to grasp the larger picture around you. And again, and I say this with tenderness towards teenagers, not with condescension. I think it is a lot is thrown at you at the same time, and there is no possible way for you to comprehend and process and put into perspective everything. And so you basically muddle your way through by sort of trying your best. And again, sometimes that is effective, and sometimes you end up in the wrong place and have to correct yourself as an adult. So I think that is exactly what Coriolanus and the other characters in the book who are all teenagers are all doing in their own way.
Yeah, it's like even myself thinking back to friends that I should have treated differently, girlfriends, lovers, whoever, that, you know, there was this moment when you could have ended up with somebody for the rest of your life, or you could just say goodbye. And, you know, that happens in movies, it happens in books all the time. And we are at the beginning of those moments for Snow, and for young adults especially, because they haven't necessarily been through the cycle of this type of behavior or relationship. I think it's a really good insight. Not that they'll necessarily listen to it.
Right, right.
But it is a good starting point. And I think that's instructive. And I also think it's very constructive of her, which she showed in the first three books as well.
Yeah.
But so how do you feel about the fact, how do you think readers will welcome the fact, especially in a prequel, and there's lots of prequels, especially in today's world, how do you think about the fact that, as some of the reviews have suggested, especially with regard to what would become a dome, that you're, rather than being inside, so to speak, in some contexts, you're outside, if you know what I mean?
As far as
the reader's viewpoint.
Right, the viewer's viewpoint. Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, there is a reason. I mean, she chose to write the book in third person instead of first. Obviously, the trilogy is Katniss's first person. With Coriolanus, it is third person and it is more at a remove. And I think that is because she wanted you to be not inside his head all the time, but instead to have that one cool remove from it, so that you could actually analyze his actions rather than be absorbed by them. And I think that, again, it's been interesting to see different people's reactions to that, because a lot of people, again, it's a hard person to spend that many pages with, because he is, you know where he's going, you know that he is not necessarily going to be right all the time, or somebody that you're rooting for to triumph. And I think that complicated relationship with the book is entirely deliberate, because, again, you are being asked as a reader to make certain choices, and including moral choices. And the book really is a device to provoke you into doing that. I think when we first announced the book, when literally all the people knew was the premise, and that it was about Coriolanus Snow 64 years earlier, at first, there was a certain sense from some quarters of outrage. Oh, how could you be humanizing the villain? But I think that the point is that there is no such thing in the real world as an inhuman villain. Every villain is a human being and has humanity. You don't have to endorse their humanity. You don't have to believe in them or excuse anything because they are human, but it is reckless to pretend that they are not human. And one of the ways that we can control sort of who gets power and understand the misuse of power is to understand the very human motivations of those who do misuse power. So again, I think it is a lot for the reader to sort of have to do, especially again, even of my friends who started reading it have said that you have to dispel the image of Donald Sutherland as an 80-year-old from your head. And you do have to sort of level set it and really convince yourself as a reader that this character who's lived with you for over a decade in one form suddenly is taking a much younger form that is in part innocent as well as guilty.
Yeah, it really is hard to not see Donald Sutherland, especially in the last scene of the last book with his laughter at the moment of his demise. It's really hard because you know he makes this journey and he gets to that point. And the other thing that's interesting is at this time in the 10th Hunger Games, they're much more primitive and not that many people were really interested in them and watching them and the districts as well. And you have a lot of the, I'll call them children because they are really, a lot of them totally opposed to the concept and expressing it to someone who's kind of in evil incarnate, especially one particular person that seems very much a hero.
Right. Yeah, no, I think it is what is interesting is hopefully the reader will rethink what they think about the Hunger Games. I mean, again, I think that seeing it in a more primitive form and seeing it sort of at the earlier basis and understanding the forces that came together to not just create it, but also to promote it, makes you understand even more how insidious it is. And I think it also shows you in some way, again, the trilogy was astonishingly just astute in sort of taking the reader and making you acutely aware of your own enjoyment of what was happening. That when there were the Hunger Games in the first three books, there would be times where you'd be turning the pages and be just enthralled by what was happening. And then something would happen, a death or just a step back, and you would actually realize, oh no, I'm actually falling for it the way that the Capitol wants me to. I was entertained and thinking of it as a game when really it's not a game. There are actually people dying. And so I think with sort of the gimmickry that the game makers were using in the first three Hunger Games books, you again had that moment where it wasn't as transparent, because there was so much hype around it and so much creativity to the way that they were punishing the tributes. Here, though, when we take it back 64 years and it is more nuts and bolts, it really is just killing. And I think that shows you sort of the true underside of what the Hunger Games is about, and then how it was made more attractive in the way that, again, our modern society makes war more attractive and tries to make it look more like a video game and more like a game that people play to desensitize us to it, when that is actually the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, it's like John Wick movies when he's killing literally hundreds of people in a movie. And it's not just suspension of disbelief. It's this idea of totally divorcing yourself from the evil things that he's doing. And that's similar to Katniss. You forgive her because she's single-minded, but single-minded by necessity.
Right.
And it's happened so many years that there is no other choice. Whereas in this, both the tributes and the mentors have second thoughts about what's happening. And even in that one scene where, you know, there's not that many microphones and there's not that much, you know, that one scene where a leg is broken, you know, there's this idea that it's just a leg, but you still have this feeling like, oh, this is really horrible, you know, these kids are doing to one another. And the cool thing, especially for the younger, you know, everyone's going to read this, but especially for the kids who are 12, 13, 16, they're going to have second thoughts about, which they didn't have in the trilogy. They're going to have second thoughts about, wait a minute, is this really necessary? Is it appropriate? Is this how we continue to maintain a principled society. And that's also going to be really interesting in the movie.
Yeah.
I don't know how you're going to do it, but it will be.
Yeah, no, I fully agree.
Yeah, so, not to jump ahead, and it's kind of a fanboy kind of question, but what is happening with the movie, which I assume is already, in production, not in production necessarily.
No, but. I mean, it's very much, they've announced it. I mean, it's the same team that did the first movies is all together again and working on the script right now. And really all systems are go. I mean, it's been really interesting to see again, because there was so much secrecy. We literally had the screenwriter in our locked room in Scholastic, which was the only place where the manuscript had a physical form, kept in a safe at night. but again, because we had thorough trust in, this has always been a partnership between the book people and the movie people. And so we really were in on it on the ground floor together for this one, which I think is very exciting. We'll see how quickly it progresses. Right now, there is something getting a little bit in the way of movie production right now. But again, hopefully this too shall pass, and that once sort of the movie industry kicks back in and it's able to actually physically film movies again, my hope is that it will proceed very quickly. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt in anybody's mind that the movie will be made. And I think it is going to be very exciting to see how a lot of these ideas are brought to the screen.
Yeah, it's funny, when you get older, as I am, the idea of 10 years passing doesn't mean the same as it means for someone who first read this when they were 10 and now are going to be in their 20s. And it's an entire life, and it makes a big difference in the way you approach it. I mean, you read the first Harry Potter book in 1998, and now it's 2020, and you still are interested in it. And the temporal aspect for growing up is very similar to what you find in the book. I mean, if you're 12 to 15 and now you're in your 20s, you're going to approach this in a completely different way than if you're 12 now.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, and again, I think it is interesting to be writing a book where you know that most people will know where it is leading. I mean, again, there are very few people who are going to start the book and not know what is going to happen with Coralina Snow. But I do, again, I think you're right that you do read it differently as an adult than you would as a teenager. And I think that what is really important to keep in mind is that it was still written for, again, the teen audience with the understanding that the adults would read it. I think some of the stodgier reviewers are sort of harping on, oh, it's so didactic. Oh, we all know about Hobbes and Rousseau and Locke. And to your point earlier on, no, the teenagers don't. And I think that, sure, if you are a reviewer who's college educated and in your 30s or 40s and are very familiar with the philosophers, yes, I'm sure there are times when it seems like you're being told something you already know. But the target audience doesn't necessarily know these philosophers or know their philosophies. And I think that this is, again, to your earlier point, such an extraordinary device to sort of introduce the thoughts to them and to really give a really concrete example to how the individual choices lead to power structures and to the fate of societies.
Yeah, not to beat a dead horse, but owning a bookstore, it's very true. Maybe only 10% of the people will read that instead of skipping it and going directly to the title page. But the ones who do, like there was this kid who was 12 years old and came into my bookstore wanting to buy War and Peace. And he was 12. And I couldn't sell it to him. I had to give it to him. There was just no way. And that's what's so cool about having the luxury of being able to own a bookstore, which doesn't necessarily make a lot of money, especially in these days. But the luxury of being able to foster that. People come in and are looking for a specific book, and then they climb up my book ladder and they see the book on either side. And one of those books might change their life.
Right.
Which is such a better thing than Amazon recommendations, because you're looking at something at random.
Right.
And so someone's going to read Frankenstein. Yeah. Someone is going to read Frankenstein because of this book. And that makes all the difference.
Yeah.
And that's why I said at the outside, you know, she is one of my heroines. Yeah. Because doing that really expands. Well, actually, you know, this book is in many ways a character study. And the epigraphs frame that because part of it is because people treat you a certain way, like the Mary Shelley quote. And the other part is that, you know, basically power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Right.
So, and, the other thing is that there's one character, and I won't get into who he or she is, that does recur other than Snow, and she is in the trilogy. Was that, I assume that was well thought out, and maybe even you had a piece of that. I don't know.
No, I mean, it was fascinating. The cameos, again, what is interesting talking to Suzanne about it afterwards is that a lot of the connections that are there were made in her head while she was writing the trilogy.
Really?
Yeah. So it is surprising. Again, some of the people or the family names that come up or other, and again, I don't want to sort of give away all the Easter eggs, but genuinely, because I sort of sat down and interviewed her afterwards, just to have an interview on file, and we'll probably use it in the paperback and things like that. But I asked her, so what are the connections? And there were two connections in there that I genuinely never would have found on my own. I mean, never in a million years. And it was fascinating to be like, okay. Again, those are the more obscure ones. The one you're referring to, again, is pretty straightforward at the front. But once you learn of the connection, yeah, you will reread the trilogy and those individual characters' roles in the trilogy much differently, knowing the backstory.
And the person is kind of a juxtaposition of the situation in which Snow finds himself. She's much more, pure. And,
yes.
You know, okay. Yeah, I know, because it's just one day that I have to tread lightly, especially since right. You couldn't even release the name of the heroine of the book. But,
right.
Talk about, if you can, the similarities and contrasts between the tribute in this book and Katniss and the district they're from.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it is, I think they're both, they have similarities, but they are also very notable in their differences. I mean, I think that obviously they are both very strong-willed characters, which helps a lot in the society that they're in. And I think being from District 12 has really forced them to be survivors. Again, I think they're very different in the stage of surviving that they're in. I mean, with Lucy Gray, without giving too much away, I mean, really has been more of a wanderer and has a very musical background and has been surviving off of her music, basically. Which is a very different, obviously, life than the one that Katniss has had, but also is basically in Pan Am at a time where it is still transitioning. It is still very shortly after the war. And again, almost like the wanderers in Europe after World War II, that's sort of how she's been raised. Whereas Katniss, again, has been forced to be strong-willed more out of direct adversity from living under the thumb of the capital. And basically her whole life has been shaped by all of the institutions that have been set up, including the Hunger Games, by the capital. And so I think there's an interesting juxtaposition. And again, I think that without giving too much away, I think obviously Katniss has an awareness of the Hunger Games that is very much based on her experience of the Hunger Games growing up and watching them. Whereas Lucy Gray, her take on the games and how she plays the game has to be much more instinctual, because she doesn't have the roadmap of previous games that she's watched. But I think that's very telling to see what instincts come out.
Yeah, and one of the things you just kind of mentioned was, like, it is an origin story, much like, say, you know, the Joker in the Batman series or Anakin Skywalker, and you discover not only how things change, but you also go back to, even in terms of music, how things originated. Right. And that's, I think, a real pleasure for the reader.
Yeah.
And I think when you see those things, it's kind of like not only nostalgic, but it gives you a sense of pleasure as now you know where this came from.
Right.
And there are several moments like that. And yeah, it must have been, you know, it's like, what's the name of the guy who wrote Game of Thrones? Martin.
George Martin, yeah.
George Martin. It's like, and this is where I think Suzanne excels. George Martin has this guy in Sweden. Like when George Martin forgets what color shirt or something somebody was wearing, he calls the guy in Sweden who's read every book so closely that he's like a concordance. And so George Martin will ask him, what color shirt was this guy wearing in chapter 3? And the guy will immediately know. And Martin has forgotten. And, you know, and there are readers out there for the Hunger Games that are exactly the same.
Oh, of course. Yeah, no, and but I think Suzanne, it is all in her head. It's kind of incredible. So I think again, things that might seem accidental or sort of spontaneous or improvised, again, when asked about it, it ends up that sort of was seated there. And there is even, and again, I don't think there's this is giving anything away. There is a passing reference to the previous victors of District 12 in the original trilogy. So there is, or not victors, but the tributes from District 12.
Right.
So I think that is really fascinating to see that sort of people are sort of scattered in the history in the trilogy, and then you see other characters come out.
Yeah, and what you're saying about Suzanne is really true, because I can't, you know, to compare it to music parlance, you know, she just dropped that YouTube video where she reads part of chapter 3, and you can see the enthusiasm that she has for what she's created.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. And then there's some other YouTube videos that give don't you think some of the reviews gave away too much? I do.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, again, I think they had a hard, I mean, the reviewers got it a very short time ago and had very quickly time to write reviews. And I think different people put the line in different places. I think most of us would have liked more secrecy, but there are certainly a whole lot of things and twists and turns that they did not put in. So that was a relief.
Yeah. Well, that's a great, as much as you can say, and the fact that it's only been a day since you, as right. you said, training wheels, that was a great insight into what's going on. And as I said, you know, there are difficult times, and it's hard, you know, it's difficult to sell books. But, you know, like I said, it's in the window. We should be able to in Pennsylvania, although the governor has been very strict, we should be able in Pennsylvania to at least do some more stuff and hopefully let some people in, even though it'll be a scattering in the coming weeks. So thanks so much
for
joining
you.
Us today. And it was a pleasure talking to you, and thanks for, you know, bearing your soul to a certain extent with regard to the book.
Right. The history will show there's plenty I could have said but did not, but I know it was really wonderful to talk to you. And again, it's wonderful to see all the independent bookstores really doing what they can to get it out. I think it's a hard time to discover new books and new authors that you've never heard of before. But I think for something like this, where it is a known quantity and people are just really trying to get it, it has been just really inspiring to see the creative lengths that independent booksellers have been going to make sure that their customers get the book on the first day or whenever they want it. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and we did do that. And of course, when I got the box that said "Do not open" in old letters, it's like when you used to have a blank, and you might be too young, and it would have a tag that said "Do not remove under penalty of law."
Right.
And my brother and I would always remove it, but we'd always be afraid that the police were going to come to our door. So yeah, in any event, when I got the box, I may or may not have opened it, but for me. I mean, I may have.
Okay.
I'm not saying one way or the other.
All right. As long as you didn't post on Twitter and Instagram look what I got, we're okay.
It was just in the darkness, unfortunately, the darkness of my bookstore.
Right.
So once again, thanks, David, so much. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.